Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as events continue to unfold in Egypt, this just in from Egyptian state television, which now officially says President Mubarak will give a speech to the nation what they call Thursday evening. They are, I think, 8 hours ahead of us, so that would be about 7:34 right now, or are they 7 hours ahead of us? But in any case, it's early evening now in Cairo, and state TV in Egypt says President Mubarak will give a speech to the nation Thursday evening. It is widely anticipated that he will announce his resignation and turn over the reins of power to his vice president, Omar Suleiman, apparently in conjunction with the Egyptian army. And coming up tomorrow on our program, we have a special that we've been planning for some time that looks like will even be more well-timed now, a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show called What Happens After a Revolution, Advice for Egypt. And we will have guests who have lived through revolutions from all over the world, from Cuba and Iran to South Africa and Eastern Europe, to compare notes on how some revolutions turn out well and some not so well. So that's tomorrow on the Brian Lehrer Show. And it may, in fact, be after the revolution in Egypt at that time, or maybe not. Meanwhile, hot news from the New York Times bestseller list. The report of the United States Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission is, as of today, officially a bestseller. Nonfiction book number 10. The commission was created by an act of Congress in 2009 to study what caused the economic meltdowns in the housing market and the banking systems that continue to plague the country to this day. And we are so pleased that the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, Phil Angelides, the former state treasurer of California, is coming on with us every Thursday this month to discuss pieces of the report. Mr. Angelides, thanks again. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be with you. And by the way, just as a little lead-in, you were talking about Egypt. I've been watching it very closely because my mother, who is of Greek descent and unfortunately passed recently, grew up as a young woman in Alexandria. And so we spent a lot of time there as kids. We had family there, and I've been watching with great interest. Just fascinating.
How do you feel watching this?
Well, I my mother just passed 3 weeks ago, and I really wish I could be talking to her about it. And I know she always had a deep love for the Egyptian people. They have a tremendous sense of pride in their nation, and I think what you see is they want to have a stake in the destiny of their country. And so it's been interesting to watch.
And I apologize for keeping your appearance very short today. But
let's do it.
We're going to come back to Egypt coverage in just a few minutes. I see on the cover here that the book sells for $14.99. So now that you're on the bestseller list, do you get the royalties?
The government will get royalties from this, and I'm pleased about that. The U.S. taxpayers, under the deal we struck, will get royalties, and so this will, in the end, accrue some benefit to the taxpayers. But, of course, as you and I know, the devastation from this financial crisis in terms of employment, loss of homes, loss of life savings, and the dramatic effect on federal, state, and local governments, of course, is in the trillions of dollars. So we'll be digging out for quite some time from the mishaps and misjudgments that led our financial system to the precipice of collapse.
So we were going to talk mostly about the section of the report on aftershocks, the impact of the problems in the financial system on the rest of the country, foreclosures, state and local government, fiscal crises, and more. We'll just have to do a little bit of that.
But
one of the pieces is that something that hasn't been talked about much in the coverage of the crisis is the failures of small and medium-sized banks. Your report says while we bailed out Citigroup and other biggies, about 300 small and medium-sized banks failed, a historically very large number. Why weren't these banks protected? Were some deemed too big to fail while these were deemed small enough to fail?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because there is this dichotomy. I mean, the fact is, I think about since January 2009, 297 banks have failed. The number of troubled institutions, smaller banks on the list of the FDIC's list of troubled institutions, rose to over 800 by the second quarter of 2010 and 860 by the third quarter. So, yes, you have this dichotomy where you you have the large banks having been saved, significant profits, and I might add that banks that have assets of $1 billion or more are the most profitable, and you have small banks failing around the country. And many of these small banks, of course, made loans in real estate. They made loans in commercial real estate. Many of them, I might add, and we held hearings around the country, a lot of them did not engage in the wild, risky subprime lending, but when home values crashed by 30%, even that 80% loan-to-value ratio, 20% down payment loan, now was in trouble, underwater. So clearly, we have had a tremendous impact of small community banks, and I think part of the phenomenon we're also seeing in the financial sector is more and more concentration of power and money in fewer and fewer money-centered banks in this country than we had even before the crisis.
Making them even more too big to fail?
Too big to fail. In fact, you know, from 1990, not to pepper you with too many numbers, but you can tell I've been working at this for a while, but from 1990 to 2005, the top 10 banks in this country went from controlling 25% of the banking assets to about 55%. Since the crash, I believe that the largest set of banks now have over 60% of the assets. And sure, we are now in a situation where there are fewer too big to fail institutions. Now, the Dodd-Frank legislation put in place resolution mechanisms to help mitigate and face that problem. But I think it's going to be an ongoing challenge for regulators and for public policymakers.
Does it relate at all to the foreclosure crisis? New foreclosure numbers out today for January and show foreclosures continuing if reduced from a year ago. Are you expecting a second wave of foreclosures, kind of a double dip foreclosure crisis? And does this consolidation in the banking sector affect it one way or the other?
Well, I think what's really affecting the second wave of foreclosures is the number of people who are remaining unemployed in this country. You know, the official numbers are 10%, but when you really look and you count people who can't get full-time work, stop looking for work, we have 26 million plus Americans out of work. And not only that, the duration of unemployment is the longest it's been. The number of people are out for just months after month after month. And I also think that the inability, the continuing foreclosures and the inability to modify mortgages is helping to keep housing prices down. It's keeping the housing market very unstable. So the combination of continued high unemployment and continued foreclosures and very difficult problems faced by homeowners who want to get their mortgages modified so they can stay in their homes is keeping the foreclosure crisis very much in front of us and a big drag on the economy.
Do you take a position on the bank's reluctance to reduce the principal in these mortgages in most cases, which experts say is the best way to keep people in their homes and to keep some kind of payments coming to the banks? Do you think government should intervene more forcefully? And do you think the banks are, I mean, we presume they're acting in what they see as their own interest, but why would they rather foreclose on a home with perhaps dim prospects of selling it immediately rather than get payments, but, you know, on the basis of a reduced principal?
So first of all, Brian, you know, during the course of our whole inquiry, I refrained from giving my opinions because we were doing an objective inquiry. But as former Governor Pat Brown of California once said when he was out of office, now I can talk frankly. Yes, I believe that we have to be much more aggressive in trying to help people who can make a level of payment stay in their homes. Now, it's interesting. This complex system of mortgages where they were made and then packaged and then repackaged and sliced and diced, this incredibly efficient system at creating millions and millions of mortgages has become very difficult to unwind. We have second mortgage holders who don't want to give up their position. A lot of the banks have sold their loans to servicers who receive substantial fees fees for guiding a mortgage through the foreclosure process. It is a we've created a tangled web, and I think we need much more forceful action. When we held hearings around the country, we heard heartbreaking stories of people who had jobs, could make payments which were far more than the bank would get out of foreclosure, but they couldn't get out. They couldn't get answers. We had one woman who had communicated 87 times with J.P. Morgan Chase and would always get an envelope back saying, J.P. Morgan Chase, your house is your home. We want to keep you in it. We heard from people who struggled to get modifications, got evicted, and 2 weeks after their home was taken away, they got the notice from the lender saying, we've approved your modification. It is a mess. You know, during the Depression, what the Roosevelt administration did is they actually set up an organization called the Homeownership, I believe, Assistance Corporation, where it was a much simpler system. The SNL still just held the loan, so your local bank, but they sent federal agents across the country, I believe thousands of federal agents, to help homeowners negotiate with banks. And the only people today getting mortgage modifications are those who are going to counseling agencies, have advocates for them, get intervention. This is not a good situation. It's hurting the economy. It's hurting the housing market. And in the end, I believe the banks are ill-served. Now, part of this is the banks don't want to write these loans down and take the losses. So, but it needs to. We need much more aggressive action.
Are we asking two simultaneous and contradictory things of the banks, to take less risk to avoid another calamity, and to take more risks by, you know, restructuring more mortgages and taking those write-downs?
Well, I think that the fact is that I think they are concerned about taking the write-downs and therefore having losses. But in the long term, if you look at what happens is when homes do go to foreclosures versus modifications, you know, the banks do end up losing money. But again, remind ourselves, because of this wonderfully efficient, quote-unquote, system of mortgages where we, you know, the banks made them, they sold them, they repackaged them. These loans are now held by servicers, a whole set of investors, a whole set of parties who have to be negotiated
right.
with.
It's a mess, as we talked about last week. One more thing before you go, and
sure.
then we return to Egypt coverage. And for those of you just tuning in, we are actually expecting the resignation of Hosni Mubarak any time now. And we will return to that coverage in just a minute as we finish up with the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, Phil Angelides. And we talked earlier in the program about the House hearing yesterday on threats to municipal bonds and whether states should be allowed to declare bankruptcy. And I'm just curious, as a former California state treasurer, for people around here, the equivalent of the New York State Comptroller, would you like to see California have the option of going into bankruptcy if that's what it takes to get out from under the weight of these pension obligations and other things?
I don't know that that's a wise move. I think what the state ought to do, I mean, it's a very wealthy state. The state ought to be able to balance its budget. We've had 20 years now of political leaders promising everything and reducing taxes, and I think what we got to do is balance our budgets and provide a level of service that people want and level with people. I think the bankruptcy route would be very damaging. One thing I want to say, last thing, Brian, on the book is I do want to remind everyone, if you go to our website, fcic.gov. You can order the book. You can download the book for free. You can order it from Public Affairs, who is our commercial publisher. You can get it from the Government Printing Office. It's an e-book. It's in paperback. And I hope people continue to go look at it. This is an important story of what happened to this country, how we came to the verge of financial collapse, and hopefully there'll be lessons learned here so we do not repeat this.
Well, congratulations on having a bestseller.
I think it shows there's a tremendous hunger in this country still, anger, confusion about what it is that brought us to the point where 4 million families have lost their homes and up to 13 million families may. $11 trillion in life savings were wiped away, and 26 million of our fellow Americans are out of work. People want to know how this happened and why it happened.
The report of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, as of today, at number 10 on the New York Times bestseller list, the chairman of the commission, Phil Angelides, coming on with us every Thursday this month to discuss aspects of the report. Thank you so much again. I'll talk to you in a week.
See you then. Bye-bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. State television says President Hosni Mubarak will speak to the nation this evening. It is evening already in Cairo. This is expected imminently. The CIA says it sees a strong likelihood that Mubarak will step down in this address. There are indications that a military coup has already taken place by the army there. Coverage coming up.